of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, April 24th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. We'll start off with a look at the weather today. It's going to be a high of 62 and a low of 33. It's going to turn partly cloudy and a little windier tomorrow with a high of 59, a low of 46, but then get ready. On Monday, we're going to have a high of 79, a low of 60, again a little partly cloudy and windy. Normal highs and lows for this time of year are 67 and 43, but in 2009 we had a record high of 87, and in 1910 the record low was 24. The Gazette's lead article has to do with vaccine demand, and it is from Michaela Ram of the Gazette, and it's titled, "As Demand Slows, Public Health Pivots to Outreach." State and local public health entities are adjusting their approach to vaccine distribution, now focusing their efforts on encouraging Iowans to get the shot as the demand for COVID-19 immunizations seems to be diminishing. 43 counties in Iowa, mostly in the Northwest region, declined some or all new vaccine shipments from the state for this week because they haven't used up their previous allocations. The week before, 20 counties had rejected new dose allocations for that week. Many of these vaccines were instead directed to more populous counties for distribution. That doesn't mean the majority of people in counties that declined the allocation already had been vaccinated. Hesitancy is likely at play, public health officials say. Now that Iowa is in a space where there is plenty of supply, state officials are focusing on reaching out to anyone who may be on the fence about receiving the vaccine, the head of the state's public health agency said this week. Though the number of fully vaccinated Iowans is increasing, there is a long way to go. As of Friday, only about 36% of Iowans age 16 and up have completed getting both shots. Kelly Garcia, director of the Iowa Department of Human Services and Iowa Department of Public Health, said Thursday during an AARP Iowa tele-town hall, "We're shifting our focus. We are also wanting to ensure that Iowans have information so they feel safe and confident in their decision to get vaccinated." The issue has gained more attention statewide in light of the pause on Johnson & Johnson allocations as federal officials investigated rare side effects. But vaccine hesitancy has been a growing issue in Iowa even before the pandemic, said Lena Tucker Reinders, executive director of the Iowa Public Health Association, pointing to declining rates of childhood immunizations as well as increasing number of anti-vaccine measures introduced in recent years in the Iowa legislature. Tucker Reinders said, "It's a concern, not just with COVID vaccines, but all vaccines. I think it comes down to trust, and there's a lot of nuance in that." For some local agencies that turned down allocations for this week, the targeted outreach has become their focus as they found they lacked capacity to host large vaccine clinics. For many, that effort entails public information campaigns about the importance of getting a shot. But one public health official said it's less about education and more about meeting people where they are. Chris Essel, administrator for Jefferson County Public Health in southeast Iowa, said, "My stance is that people have access to the vaccine and they have access to accurate, science-based information. There are so many reputable resources available, but you still have individuals that chose not to follow science-based information." The county had turned down its weekly allocation of 300 Moderna doses, Essel said. As of April 20th, about 59% of Jefferson County residents age 60 and above were vaccinated, but only about 20% of people between 50 and 64 and between 19 and 49 were fully vaccinated. Essel said, "It's unfortunate at the point vaccine is readily available and accessible in a number of venues, we are seeing vaccine hesitancy for various reasons." The slow acceptance of the vaccine from their residents is a major change from the early days of the vaccine rollout, when local public health officials scrambled to administer shots as quickly as possible. The demand far outpaced the supply at the time, leaving many Iowans frustrated when they were unable to schedule appointments before clinics were booked. Individuals were driving from three counties away to attend vaccine clinics hosted in Davis County in southeast Iowa, said Devin Pitlick, Public Information Officer for Davis County Public Health. But starting 3 weeks ago, County Public Health there began seeing a decline in residents signing up for its clinics. Typically, 120 people would be vaccinated per week, Pitlick said. Only about 21% of Davis County's population was vaccinated as of April 20th, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Because officials had vaccine supply left, Davis County opted to send its allocation to another entity, saying, because of the slowdown, we're starting to evaluate and look at additional outreach we're going to be doing. We'll be using this opportunity to educate people and hopefully boost the percentage of people vaccinated. Tucker Reinder said the slowdown in demand doesn't necessarily mean people in those counties have stopped seeking out the vaccine. Doses are making their way into the community through federal programs to other providers, including one that ships directly to retail pharmacies. Tucker Reinders noted that barriers to access are likely a contributing factor. Some populations, including those without internet or transportation access, those who don't speak English, or those who face barriers to health care, are still struggling to get vaccinated in some parts of Iowa. Despite some hesitancy among Iowans, the head of the state's public health agency also expressed optimism this week about the state's chances for reaching herd immunity against the novel coronavirus. In fact, Garcia said, Iowa has had a phenomenal start in vaccinating residents. To encourage people that getting the vaccine is for the greater good, Essel's focus is leaning on the trust residents have for local public health officials and providers. Essel said residents may not trust the word of federal or state officials, but because she has a relationship with many in her small rural county, they may be more willing to get the shot if they see her receiving the vaccine. Essel said, I think we have to understand and not harm the relationships we currently have by just having an adult conversation. Public health is just that, the health of the public. That means I need the public to help me take care of the health of the public. It's a group effort. And as we move to the Iowa Today section, we'll start with an article that relates to the article we just read, and this one is titled, Iowa football star Dallas Clark and Lieutenant Governor Gregg get COVID shots. This is by Zach James of the Sioux City Journal. Dateline Sioux City. Because Iowa men are falling behind in getting COVID-19 vaccinations, Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg and former Hawkeye and NFL tight end Dallas Clark stepped up Friday and got their shots at the Siouxland Expo Center. According to Gregg, 2.1 million doses of the vaccine have been distributed among Iowans, but the split isn't even between men and women. According to Gregg, 56% of those doses have gone to women and 44% to men. Recent polling has shown that one-third of men do not plan to get the vaccine and 40% of rural residents aren't planning on being vaccinated, according to Gregg. He said, we're concerned that disparity is going to grow. Guys, why are we falling short? We're here to persuade you that it's the right thing to do for you, your family, and your community. By getting the vaccine, you're protecting your loved ones. Gregg, Clark, and prominent members of the Sioux City sports scene gathered to help promote the state's message. Clark, who played 143 games in the NFL, said, the only thing that makes sense is getting the vaccine. I want to encourage people to get vaccinated. I fall into that category of younger 40s age and thinking, oh, I don't need to worry about getting vaccinated because it's not going to be available. It's going to be a while until I make that decision. Now it's our choice and we have to do our part. Clark added, I think you have to put away the politics, this or that or whatever reason you're not getting it. I really hope you reflect and change your mind and become more proactive. Clark received his second COVID-19 shot, which he'd originally planned to get Thursday in Humboldt. And there's a sidebar article giving the daily totals about vaccination and cases of COVID. I'm going to pull some excerpts from that rather than read that full article. The article does include this information that in Linn County, 70,951 people, or 31.3% of the county's total population, have been vaccinated as of Friday afternoon. In Johnson County, the number is 54,899, or 36.32% of the county's total population. Now, nationally, as of the time this went to press, the CDC reported about 222 million doses had been administered. This is as of 6 a.m. Yesterday, Friday, with 27.5% of the country's total population being fully vaccinated. Moving into the new cases, Iowa added 431 COVID-19 cases and 3 confirmed deaths on Friday, bringing the state's total COVID to 362,242 and the death toll to 5,907. The 7-day average for cases is 426 and average for deaths is 4. In Linn County, 28 cases were added Friday. The county's 7-day average for new cases is 25. In Johnson County, they added 19 and their 7-day average is 27. As of Friday, of the confirmed deaths, 2 were in people over 80, 1 was between 61 and 80. And as far as hospitalizations, they went from 235 to 217 as of Wednesday, with a decrease in ICU admissions from 56 to 51. Number of patients on ventilators remained at 24. And we still have one long-term care facility in Iowa with a COVID-19 outbreak with 18 cases. Since the start of the pandemic, 2,309 people have died in Iowa long-term care facilities, and that represents 39% of the fatalities reported in the state. Also from Iowa today is this from Michaela Ram of the Gazette, and it's titled Reynolds Advisor to Head Iowa's Medicaid Program. A health policy advisor for the governor has been appointed as the new director of Iowa Medicaid Enterprises. Elizabeth Matney will start June 1st, overseeing the state's $5 billion Medicaid Managed Care Program, which serves more than 700,000 poor and disabled Iowans each year. Matney serves as Governor Kim Reynolds' health policy advisor, a position she's held since June 2019. Matney was appointed by Kelly Garcia, director of the Iowa Department of Human Services, after a nationwide search. She was the unanimous pick of the interview committee made up of key health care system stakeholders, according to a news release. The appointment is not subject to Iowa Senate confirmation. Garcia said in a statement, "This is an exciting time for our Medicaid program. I'm thrilled about the vision and expertise Matney brings to the program. She knows Iowa. She knows our program. She is the right choice. She will be able to hit the ground running on day one." Matney also has worked for the Iowa DHS in a variety of roles with the state's Medicaid program, including as the Medicaid Managed Care Director and Medicaid Quality Assurance Director. Her previous work includes experience as a Medicaid Direct Care Provider and at a women's shelter, according to the announcement. Matney holds a master's degree in rehabilitation counseling from Drake University and a bachelor's degree in psychology and philosophy from Texas State University. Nearly 800,000 Iowans are projected to receive health coverage from the state's Medicaid program in fiscal 2021, according to a DHS report. Most Medicaid members are insured by 2 managed care organizations, private insurance companies, Amerigroup, and Iowa Total Care. As of the second quarter of the Iowa's fiscal 2021, about 720,000 Iowans received their Medicaid benefits from a managed care organization. Matney said in a statement, "This is the opportunity of a lifetime, and this is my passion." She also said, "Medicaid is a large and complex program full of nuance, rules, and regulation. But on the other end of that are people. People who rely on us to be there and meet their needs. I am committed to working with our team and providing the leadership needed to do just that." Matney steps into the role after the former director, Michael Randall, departed in August 2020 to take an unspecified job in the private sector. Deputy Medicaid Director Julie Lovelady was interim director. Randall, who previously led the private Medicaid program in Kansas for 5 years, had been hired by Reynolds to stabilize Iowa's Medicaid program, which has been plagued with criticism since it was privatized in April 2016. From early on, since the switch to managed care organizations have left the state's program due to what they described as chronic underfunding. The most recent exit occurred in 2019 when United Healthcare of the River Valley, which carried the majority of members, announced it would withdraw. We typically don't read national articles here, but there's just a little tiny news bite here that may be of interest to some of our listeners. So this is Tom. New law designates sesame as allergen. Dateline Washington. President Joe Biden on Friday signed into law a new measure that designates sesame as the 9th major food allergy and ramps up allergy research, enacting a bipartisan attempt to address marked growth in certain deadly allergies. The new law, called the Food Allergy Safety, Treatment, Education, and Research Act, also known as the FASTER Act, passed the Senate in March and the House earlier this month. It received bipartisan support. This law will require foods containing sesame to be clearly labeled by January 2023. The legislation also says the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services must prioritize regularly reviewing promising food allergy treatments and research. And now we'll move to some non-health related news. This is by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette, titled Election Set for Johnson Supervisor Vacancy. The vacancy on the Johnson County Board of Supervisors will be filled by special election. Johnson County voters will go to the polls June 8th to fill the seat of former Supervisor Janelle Rettig, who resigned last weekend. The decision to hold a special election was made Friday by a committee consisting of County Auditor Travis Weipert, County Recorder Kim Painter, and County Treasurer Tom Criz. Weipert said, "I like letting the parties and letting the people pick." Had the committee appointed someone, a petition of 8,350 signatures would have been needed to challenge that selection and force a special election. Given ongoing concerns associated with the COVID-19 pandemic, Painter said she was not comfortable forcing people to go out into the public to collect signatures, saying even one serious case of COVID would dwarf the dollar amount of holding a special election. Weipert said the special election likely will cost about $70,000 to $80,000. Criz voted against the special election in favor of appointment. By having the local Democratic and Republican parties select their nominees, other candidates might not get a fair shot at running for the board, though people can petition to be placed on the ballot, she said. She also said, "I think it opens up some territory for people that might not be what I would call extremely politically active, but maybe extremely pro our community, wanting to make a difference," she said as she spoke in favor of a special election. The local parties will now hold conventions to select their candidates for supervisor. The county's 5 supervisors are paid $84,836 a year. And we have some news about a concert that's been booked at the Extreme Arena in Coralville. This also written by Lee Hermiston. Toby Keith booked for first concert at Extreme Arena. And Lee says, "Grab your red solo cup. Toby Keith is coming to Extreme Arena." Extreme Arena announced Friday that the country music star will be the venue's first concert. Keith will headline the arena on October 14th with guest Matt Stell. "As a brand new venue, this is a long-awaited announcement for us and the city of Coralville, and for the first announced concert to be someone with the talent and popularity of Toby Keith, we could not be more thrilled to work with TK and Pepper Entertainment on this show," said Extreme Arena manager Jack Ligon in a statement. The roughly $70 million arena and sports complex opened in September 2020 and has hosted sporting events and soon will be home to a USHL hockey team. But this marks the first music event for the highly anticipated venue with a capacity of 6,600 for concerts. Coralville Mayor John Lundell said in a statement, With this first concert announcement and the caliber of talent, the city of Coralville and its residents have another reason to look forward to visiting Extreme Arena and the Iowa River Landing. Keith has released 19 studio albums and is known for such hits as Should Have Been a Cowboy and Red Solo Cup. Stell, a country musician, has released 4 albums. Tickets go on sale next Friday at 10 a.m. through ExtremeArena.com or at the Extreme Arena box office. We also have an update on a court-related article, this by Trish Mahaffey, titled Man Accused in 2011 Cedar Rapids Slaying to Get Mental Competency Exam. Dateline Cedar Rapids. It took nearly 10 years to make an arrest in the fatal shooting of Dexter Meeks and the attempt on his brother's life in 2011, but now there will be further delay in the trial of the man arrested because he has asked for a mental competency evaluation. 6th Judicial District Judge Chad Kipros suspended proceedings earlier this week for Michael A. Roberts, age 29, accused of first-degree murder, attempted murder, and going armed with intent until a competency evaluation is completed at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Coralville. Roberts' lawyer in the application for an evaluation said she received information from his family, friends, and medical records that indicate he has a history of mental illness. Sarah Smith, his public defender, said Roberts also has displayed erratic behavior while in jail, which causes concerns regarding his mental state. Roberts, she said in the application, may not understand legal concepts and may have a mental impairment or disorder that prevents him from understanding court proceedings and assisting in his defense. Assistant Linn County Attorney Jordan Shire did not resist the request. Roberts will have his competency evaluation virtually, according to court documents. Dr. Jerome Greenfield, Health Services Administrator at the Coralville Prison, said in a letter to Kipros, the forensic psychiatric hospital at the prison isn't seeing outside visitors, which includes defendants needing competency evaluations. All outpatient evaluations, he said, are conducted by video through the hospital's and county jail's secured networks. Roberts, who was in a California prison a year ago, was charged in February in Meek's slaying. A criminal complaint states Roberts confessed to the June 25, 2011 fatal shooting of Meeks, age 22, and to shooting his brother Andrew, who was sitting next to him on the porch outside Dexter's apartment at 211 15th Street Southeast. Roberts said he intended to kill Andrew Meeks that early morning instead of his brother, according to the complaint. At the time of the shooting, Andrew Meeks was unable to identify his brother's shooter. He told police his brother pushed him out of the line of fire that day. In July 2, 2017, Andrew Meeks was killed when he and another man were shot inside a car at the Westside Walmart. Corzone Martin, age 28, of Cedar Rapids, was convicted in that slaying. The conviction was overturned last summer by the Iowa Court of Appeals. Last year, the Stanislaus County Sheriff's Department in Modesto, California, called Cedar Rapids Police cold case investigator Matt Denlinger, saying an inmate, Roberts, had information about a 2011 murder in Cedar Rapids, but was uncertain of the victim's name. According to court documents, Roberts was at Wasco State Prison in Wasco, California. In April 2020, Roberts provided Cedar Rapids investigators a complete, detailed confession that supported and corroborated many details of the shooting that killed Dexter Meeks, according to court documents. Aaron Jordan of the Gazette has provided this article, Iowa Dems Renew Calls for More Prison Staff After Tour. Iowa Democrats say the state should spend $34 million to fill more than 500 vacant prison jobs after the March 23rd murders of 2 Anamosa prison staffers called attention to chronic understaffing. A handful of state lawmakers on Friday toured the Anamosa State Penitentiary, where they talked with employees and saw crowded conditions, they said in a news conference afterwards. Senator Zach Walls, Democrat of Coralville, said over and over and over, we were shown areas of the prison where you have a huge number of inmates, vastly outnumbering the number of staff who are there. Representative Marty Anderson, Democrat of Des Moines, said she too was struck by the offender-to-staff ratio, saying, "I am beside myself when I go in a cell block that has 300 offenders to two prison guards. That has to change. We have to have more staff." Two inmates, Michael Dutcher and Thomas Woodard, face murder, kidnapping, and attempted murder charges based on allegations that they struck Anamosa Correctional Officer Robert McFarland and Nurse Lorena Schulte in the head with hammers, killing them. They also briefly took another employee hostage and seriously wounded an inmate. Iowa's prison system had 265 vacant positions as of March 31st, which included 122 open jobs for correctional workers and 64 for nurses. Wall said the state should spend $16 million filling those jobs and $18 million hiring another 300 prison employees to fill positions authorized at one point but removed because there wasn't enough money in the budget for multiple budget cycles. Lawmakers said the Department of Corrections also must update technology, especially prison radios staff use to call for help. Iowa OSHA last year proposed penalties for the department based on the Anamosa Prison and the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Coralville having radios that were not always functional. U.S. Representative Cindy Axne, a Democrat, earlier this week asked for a federal probe of the attack and staffing issues. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, a Republican, told reporters Friday she thought it was the state's role to investigate, saying, "I think we absolutely need to get to the bottom of what happened there, but I don't know if a federal investigation is necessary. I know that our state officials are asking questions and looking into this as well." Also, an article from the Gazette's Des Moines Bureau titled "Iowa Getting $52.9 Million in Tobacco Money." Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller said Friday Iowa's share of the 1998 landmark settlement with U.S. tobacco companies has now exceeded $1.36 billion. Officials within Miller's office say the Iowa Treasury has received an annual transfer payment of about $52.9 million from tobacco companies involved in the multi-state master settlement agreement, the largest settlement in U.S. history. Iowa will continue to receive yearly settlement payments in perpetuity based on the number of cigarettes sold in the United States. In the last 22 years, Iowa has received more than $1.36 billion in those payments. Miller said in a statement, "This settlement is nearly a quarter century old, but our office must diligently monitor and enforce the agreement's provisions every year so Iowa gets its fair share of the settlement." About $11.6 million of this year's payment, or 22%, will go to the state. According to the AG's office, the remaining 78% will be used principally to pay bondholders who bought bonds issued by the Tobacco Settlement Authority. State Treasurer Michael Fitzgerald announced Wednesday that Iowa refunded its tobacco settlement bonds this month, resulting in more than $167 million in savings for the state over the life of the bonds. In 1998, Miller and attorneys general of 45 states signed an agreement with the nation's four largest tobacco companies to settle lawsuits and recover billions in state health care costs associated with treating smoking-related illnesses. The 2020 payment came from 29 companies, including Philip Morris USA, R.J. Reynolds, Santa Fe Natural Tobacco, Vector, and Commonwealth Brands. The central purpose of the Master Settlement Agreement was to reduce smoking, particularly among youth. The settlement created restrictions on the advertising, marketing, and promotion of cigarettes, including a ban on targeting children through advertising. It includes prohibitions on outdoor advertising of cigarettes, the advertising of cigarettes in public transit facilities, and the use of cigarette brand names on merchandise. There is no local editorial or guest column today on the Insight page. There is one community letter. This is from Glenn Freeman of Mount Vernon, and it's under a title, "Civilians with Guns Won't Make Us Safer." Gun rights activists would have us believe that more guns in civilian hands makes us safer and protects us from criminals with guns. Kim Potter's recent shooting of Dante Wright should call that into question. A 26-year veteran of the police force accidentally pulls her gun instead of her taser. We have to ask whether this was really an accident. The taser, bright yellow, was in her left holster and would have to have been pulled with her left hand. But if it was an accident, then why do we believe that civilians with guns aren't going to make similar deadly mistakes when they're in the heat of action? No civilian is trained to pull a gun on another human, and it's dangerous to think they can serve as a safeguard for our lives during any active shooter situation. Isn't it just as likely that an untrained citizen will shoot the wrong person as a trained professional grabs the wrong gun? No, there are only two options here that I see. Either Kim Potter did not make a mistake and should be convicted of manslaughter at a minimum, or the notion that more guns on the street make us safer is a lie. You can't have it both ways. Neither side of the equation makes me feel any safer, says Glenn Freeman of Mount Vernon. As a reminder, you are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, April 24th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. We will start out with the shorter notices. From Dyersville, Clarabelle Frances Baum, B-A-U-M, age 98, died Wednesday, April 21st. Arrangements are being handled through Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. In Monticello, Bernice Schaefer Gilmer, age 92, died Thursday, April 22nd. Getch Funeral Home is handling those arrangements. In Waukon, Daniel W. Howe, age 43, died Wednesday, April 21st, and the family is being assisted by Martin Grau Funeral Home. And in West Union, Edward Lewis Stepan, age 85, died Thursday, April 22nd. His arrangements are being handled through Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in West Union. Moving to the longer notices, Joseph Daniel Pfeiffner, I'm going to spell it P-F as in Frank, I-F-F-N-E-R, age 37 of Cedar Rapids, died April 22nd at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics following a traumatic brain injury. A funeral mass will be held at St. Pius Catholic Church on Wednesday, April 28th at 10:30 a.m. with visitation at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home from 4 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, April 27th. Following continued guidance from health officials, physical distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people into the visitation at one time and the use of face masks or shields. They specifically include in this notice, in keeping with Joseph's loving and generous spirit, it was his decision to donate life so others may live it. The family extends a special thank you to the Iowa Donor Network for their care and guidance, and says that in lieu of flowers, memorials may be given to the Willis Dady Homeless Shelter for Veterans. Bruce Allen Andry of Cedar Rapids passed away in his home on Tuesday, April 20th, at the age of 67 from pulmonary fibrosis. Services will be private following his cremation. Judith, also known as Judy, Ann Briggs, age 78 of Marion, died on Thursday, April 22nd at the Hiawatha Care Center. A graveside service will be held on Saturday, May 1st at 2:30 p.m. at Fremont Cemetery in rural Winthrop. Interment will also be at that location. Because of COVID-19, masks are recommended at the cemetery. And the family has included a particular notice that says they want to thank Judy's caregivers for caring and compassionate care she received while residing at the Hiawatha Care Center, and also thank the medical personnel and staff at the Hall Perrine Cancer Center. Kathy Marie Woodman, age 71, of Belle Plaine, passed away April 22nd at her home. Her memorial service is at 1 p.m. this coming Tuesday at Grace Community Church in Belle Plaine. Burial will be at Oak Hill Cemetery in Belle Plaine. The service will also be live streamed through the Funeral Home Facebook page. Visitation will be this coming Monday between 4 to 7 p.m. at Rehbock Niehaus Funeral Home in Belle Plaine. And they say that they ask everyone to be mindful of social distancing, and they request that masks be worn if you are going to attend. In Dyersville, Judy Ann Geistkemper, age 73, passed away on Thursday, April 22nd at her home. Visitation will be from 2 to 7 p.m. tomorrow, April 25th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville, where American Legion Auxiliary will conduct a rosary at 4 p.m. Visitation will continue on Monday from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. at Kramer Funeral Home prior to the services. They also will live stream the service. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, April 26th, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville, with a committal service in the church cemetery and private burial at a later date. Masks and social distancing at all events is encouraged. The family does wish to thank the medical staff, Unity Point at Home, and Hospice of Dubuque for their kind and compassionate care. We have two more obituaries to share with you. This one for Irvin Walter Irv Peterson, age 76, of Rhinebeck, who passed away Thursday, April 22nd, at his home while under the care of Cedar Valley Hospice. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. tomorrow at the Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, French Hand Chapel in Rhinebeck, where the family requests that masks be worn. The Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. this coming Monday at St. Gabriel Catholic Church in rural Rhinebeck, and there masks are mandatory. The Mass will be live streamed on the St. Gabriel Church Facebook page for those unable to attend, and burial will follow at the Rhinebeck Cemetery with military honors. Final obituary is for Eileen Marie Sigler Eastlick, age 87, who died April 7th due to complications of Alzheimer's disease. She was born in Strawberry Point but spent most of her life and career in Waterloo. The family spends a fair amount of the obituary offering thanks to a number of people, including the staff at Friendship Village and various employees there, also the Cedar Valley Hospice, and to Sister Madonna from Blessed Sacrament, which is where the services will be held on Saturday, May 1st, 2 p.m. at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church, with burial in the Garden of Memories Cemetery. There will be a live stream of that service. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, April 30th, at Haggerty Wyckoff Garrett Funeral Service on West Ridgeway, and at the church for an hour before services on Saturday. Moving to sports, we have an article about boys soccer by Nathan Ford, and it's titled West Putting It Together. Dateline Iowa City. It's cliche at this point to call this year in high school sports unprecedented. Still, sometimes you forget it's not just because of the masks and limited attendance and postponed games here and there. Take the Iowa City West boys soccer team. It's a deep and talented team, one ranked number 5 in Class 3A with just one loss in overtime. But in this unprecedented season, you could call what happened Thursday a milestone. It marked the first team dinner of the year, outside at a park, but a somewhat normal team dinner nonetheless. West Coach Brad Stiles said, "To see all those guys actually sit and hang out and not be at the soccer field and not have to worry about what I have to say, it looked like the weight was off their shoulders." Developing that camaraderie can only help in a team sport like this, as it started to last night in West's 3-1 win over number 16 Iowa City High at Ed Barker Soccer Complex. The Trojans put 2 goals on the board in the game's first 20 minutes, then withstood a second-half City High charge to improve to 7-1. City High is 3-2. Coach Stiles said, "I've thought a couple times, we're behind schedule. It's just these guys haven't spent as much time off the field together. It's just going to take a little bit." Sophomore Michael Nelson scored the opener on a cutback pass from Colby Godbolt in the 7th minute. Owen Smith headed in a corner kick in the 20th minute, and West looked like it could comfortably put the game away. But City High didn't go quietly against its crosstown rival, catching the Trojans napping after a cleared corner kick that was launched back into the box and poked in by Alima Munga to slice the lead in half with 37-37 to go. City High outshot West 9-5 in the final 40 minutes, but the Trojans were able to seal the win when Brendan Klutz slipped a pass to Godbolt for the final goal with 4:29 left. Smith said we needed to take a few deep breaths and just focus on keeping the ball more than anything. I think it ended up being good for us because we put another one in the back of the net at the end of the game. Godbolt, Smith, and Nelson were all playing in their first West City game, another sign of an unusual season that isn't lost on anyone involved. Godbolt, who started his high school career at Iowa City Liberty, said, "It wasn't perfect, but I had a great time, and that's what's important. It's my senior year. I get one shot at it and made it count." There aren't other prep stories in the sports section, but there are a few little bits and pieces for some schools that may not always get quite as much of attention in other media sources. So I'm going to read a few excerpts from there. One is about women's basketball for Kirkwood. And it says, Kirkwood advanced to the fifth place game with a 50-45 consolation bracket victory over Iowa Central at the NJCAA Women's Basketball Tournament Friday in Hickory, North Carolina. Kirkwood, with a 23-2 record, wraps up its season today against USC Salkehatchee for fifth place at 1 p.m. Also about Big Ten softball, Amber Fizer struck out 6 and pitched a complete game 2-hit shutout as Minnesota beat the University of Iowa women's softball team 3-0 last night in Minneapolis. The Hawkeyes play a doubleheader against the Gophers today before closing out the 4-game series with a single game tomorrow. And there's also a co-college baseball story under the title Johnson Fills Many Roles with Cohawks, written by K.J. Pilcher. Dateline Cedar Rapids. T.J. Johnson serves as a jack-of-all-trades at Co. He's proven his versatility, playing shortstop, serving as a closer on the mound, and providing a consistent presence in the batting lineup from day one with the Cohawks baseball program. This season, he'll assume a different pitching role, switching to starter duty, in addition to his infield work and hitting third. Johnson, a former Cedar Rapids Prairie prep, said, "I started in high school. I knew I was able to do it. It was more of getting my arm conditioned to be able to handle that volume. It was something I wanted to do because I think I'd be able to help the team out," end quote. Johnson leads Co. in wins and produced another quality start in an American Rivers Conference doubleheader split with Dubuque on Friday at Daniels Park's Bill Quinby Field. The Spartans won the opener 2-1, and Co. rebounded with a 9-2 victory in Game 2. Johnson went the distance, suffering his first loss this season despite allowing just 4 hits without an earned run. Co-coach Steve Cook said, "Anytime you get into the conference, you know you're going to have a battle. We never really got into a groove offensively in Game 1. Overall, I thought we played well today. We have to try to score a few more runs to win that first one." Due to some injuries and players unable to return from last year's shortened season, the Cohawks needed to bolster their rotation. Cook had Johnson in mind when Johnson reached out and offered to make the move. Johnson is 7-1 with a 2.38 earned run average. Cook said, "It felt like we had good quality depth, but we didn't necessarily have a lot of starting pitching back, so we made the decision to move TJ to starter. He's become our number one starter on the weekends. He's done an awesome job." Johnson is second in batting with a .394 batting average, tallying 2 hits, an RBI, and a run in the nightcap. He also has a team-high 9 doubles, 28 RBIs, and 63 total bases. He said, "He likes contributing in as many ways as possible, and it's something I embrace." Co scored 3 runs in the 4th and 7th to pull away from Dubuque in Game 2. Riley LeGrand had 3 hits, and Jack Allison and T.J. Deerdorf, who hit a solo home run, added two hits apiece for Coe, which is 23-4 overall and 19-3 in the conference. Sean Laquan threw a complete game for Dubuque in the first game. In the Gazette's business section is an article titled Large Solar Farm Set for Coggin. A 750-acre solar farm will be built 2 miles outside Coggin in northern Linn County, with plans to generate about 100 megawatts when it begins operation in 2022. Boise, Idaho-based Clenera will build the farm and sell the power to the Central Iowa Power Cooperative, or CIPCO, through a 25-year power purchase agreement, said Carrie Kuntz, CIPCO Manager of External Affairs. Energy output will be the same as the 800-acre Wapello solar facility in Louisa County, also constructed by Clenera and operated by Cedar Rapids-headquartered CIPCO. The project will contribute several million dollars in property tax revenue to Linn County over the life of the generating facility, Clenera said in a statement posted on CIPCO's website. The company said 350 construction workers will be employed at its peak. Bill Cherrier, CIPCO CEO and Executive Vice President, said in a statement, "We're pleased with the economics behind the Coggin Solar Agreement. This will serve our mission of providing cost-effective and safe energy. The fact that the energy is produced in Iowa and promotes environmental stewardship is a win-win," end quote. And from the Living section, this article by Elijah Decius titled Blazing a Trail, and this is about an Iowa freshman who is among the inaugural class of female Eagle Scouts. Dateline, Iowa City. Being a trailblazer as one of the first Iowa women to achieve the Eagle Scout rank in Boy Scouts of America is something Greta Stock, age 18, has gotten used to. That attitude is not a matter of cockiness, but rather the mindset of a woman who had to work to earn respect in a world she was prohibited from participating in just a few years ago. The University of Iowa freshman, who in 2 years moved through 7 ranks to become an Eagle Scout, says it was more difficult than I thought it was going to be. This is something her male counterparts who get involved in BSA earlier usually do in about 7 years. But she actually beat her own brother involved in Scouts years before Greta in earning the coveted rank. She says, "That was my motivation." Undeterred by the negative sentiments toward girls and women being allowed to fully participate in Scouts, Stock set out in Annapolis, Maryland's Troop 396 to prove them wrong. She said, "I saw all the backlash when I Googled it. The number one thing you do to beat the backlash isn't to go online. It's to be an Eagle Scout." With the requirements to achieve the rank no different for her than for any boy, she set out to achieve something objective that naysayers couldn't easily argue with. But along the way, she became more than a participant. Her visible example as a mentor in a first-year program for girls served as a reminder to other girls and Scouts that they belong, no matter what men may say. She said, "I wanted to make them feel like they were supposed to be there." In a male-dominated space, that involves more than a passive presence, though. She said, "I don't think the girls should have been allowed in," or she heard others say, "I don't think the girls should have been allowed in. They're not capable." She said, "You can't talk about that stuff out loud," confronting them as she reminded them of the duties in their paid positions. "People can hear you. Scouting is supposed to be accepting." As a senior patrol leader, she was not referred to by her title, and other boys would often go to male senior patrol leaders first. When boys lost a portion of bathroom space so girls could have bathrooms, she heard the complaints. But on February 8th, she proved that girls are in fact capable and deserving. When she was recognized alongside 1,000 other young women with the highest rank on the BSA's 111th anniversary. Stock said, "It does mean a lot to me that I can say, but it meant a lot to my parents and the adult leaders in my troop, and that means a lot. A lot of the adult leaders remember what it was like before girls were allowed to participate." A creative writing and French major, the Maryland native with family roots in Iowa, comes from a proud family tradition of scouting. Her grandfather, Larry Hatch, earned the rank in 1953 in addition to the Distinguished Silver Beaver Award. Though he died before Greta was born, those who knew him said he would have been proud. Holly Stock, Greta's mother, said it's full circle, the family experience in keeping a legacy going. It warmed my heart that even though I lost my dad when I was young, she could come full circle. And it brought back memories of my dad. He'd surely be proud of her. Holly said that Greta has always had nerves of steel and was up for challenges as a child. She said, I'm just so very proud that she could be a trailblazer and set the course for future girls to be able to join the party and have fun just like everyone else. Darlene Hatch, Greta's grandmother from Marion, said Larry would have been ecstatic. She said it was just a given for boys in their family to be in scouts. Now, that given can apply to girls in the family, too. Out of Darlene's 2 children and 4 grandchildren, Greta is the first to become an Eagle Scout. Joel Waymeyer, president of the BSA's Mid-Iowa Council, said in a February news release, "We're elated that this opportunity is now available to even more youth, young men and women alike." On average, only about 6% of Scouts earn the pinnacle rank of Scouting. To earn Eagle Scout rank, Scouts are required to take on leadership roles within their troop and community, earn 21 merit badges across a broad range of topics, and complete a large community service project. Greta's project, a mural brightening a dark hallway in her Annapolis church, displays 1 Timothy 4, verse 12, which encourages youth to not be deterred by anyone looking down on them due to their age. Greta has plans to someday become a pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, where her experience as a woman in a male-dominated field will come in handy. As of 2018, only 32% of ELCA clergy were women. The Eagle Scout was inspired by her own pastor, a woman, to ensure inclusivity remains a part of the church for future generations. She said there's a lot of people out there that are using Christianity as a way of putting down or discriminating against transgender people, gay people, LGBT people in general, and it's driving a lot of people away from the church. With all the good she thinks the church still does, she wants to ensure the institution survives to benefit people the way it helped her. Greta said, I didn't just want to stand by. I was seeing all these issues, and rather than leaving it, I thought I'd make a change myself. She sees the parallels between her journey in scouting and what she hopes to achieve in the church, and the article concludes with her quote, "It is important to have a female presence in all spaces, including the church." We have time for one more article, this one from the Our Iowa magazine. I'm going to read you some excerpts. This is from their February and March 2021 issue, and it's all about someone by the name of Hillbilly Bob. This is written by Carol Wooden, Voice of Dysart. When Bob Hill unloaded his 1929 Ford Model A at a fancy car show in Grinnell years ago, he was met with guffaws of laughter. The reason? The show's attendees were expecting something shiny and restored, not a car looking like the one Jed and Granny Clampett would be driving through Beverly Hills. The Model A, which Bob calls Old Ruthie after a former neighbor who had been like a grandmother to him, had been sitting in a hedgerow in Missouri for 15 years before he purchased it. Later that year, after he gussied up the car with dozens of odds and ends from his farm sheds, he took Ruthie to the annual cattle congress in Waterloo, hoping it would help draw attention to the local FFA group that was selling raffle tickets for a fundraiser. A booking agent, impressed with his act, asked how long he'd been on the road as Hillbilly Bob. He looked at his watch and said, "Oh, for about 3 hours." That was when he realized he and Ruthie could possibly have some fun making other people laugh by helping to brighten their days. Bob grins and says, "Turns out I've been doing my own share of the laughing for the past 27 years. He's traveled to 41 states and Canada, entertaining spectators at fairs, festivals, and rodeos, and even made a few private guest appearances. This past year, all his events were canceled due to COVID-19, and nobody missed the good times and laughter more than Bob. He looks forward to getting back to doing what he loves best this coming summer, because he enjoys meeting new people. He says, I have the best job at the fairgrounds. He strolls the grounds of the events he attends, leaning on his cane and making people laugh with his witty comments. but he and his trusty Ruthie have carried some mighty distinguished passengers over the years. Iowa's former governor Terry Branstad got a ride once when he was running for re-election. Another former governor, Ben Nelson of Nebraska, along with a state trooper and three fair board members, got the same special treatment during Nebraska's Sarpy County Fair parade. Bob is a seventh generation to have lived on his family's 167-year-old farm in northern Tama County. His great-grandfather is buried in a family cemetery at the end of the lane. He has a custom farming arrangement in place with another farmer in the area to take care of the crops while he's traveling to events during the summer. Hillbilly Bob spreads joy and happiness to others through his silly antics with Ruthie the Model A as his partner, his words of wisdom and spiritual strength. He's firmly rooted in the history of his farm, but he's also a visionary, helping others find hope and laughter among the challenges they face in today's world. Well, that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, April 24th. I've been your reader, Mary Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.